Harry rose early the following morning and decided to take a stroll around Red Square. It was impossible to miss Lenin's mausoleum, which dominated the square and served as a constant reminder of the founder of the Soviet state. The Kremlin was guarded by a massive bronze cannon, another symbol of victory over another enemy. Even wearing the overcoat insisted on by Emma with the collar turned up, Harry's ears and nose had quickly turned red with the cold. He now understood why the Russians wore those magnificent fur hats, accompanied by scarves and long coats. Locals passed him on their way to work, but few of them gave him a second look, despite the fact that he was continually slapping himself. When Harry returned to the hotel, rather earlier than planned, the concierge handed him a message. Pierre Bouchard, the conference chairman, hoped he would be able to join him for breakfast in the dining room.
"I have allocated you the 11 o'clock slot this morning," said Bouchard,
having already given up on some scrambled egg that could never have seen a chicken.
"It's always the best attended of the conference meetings. I will open proceedings at 10:30, when I'll welcome the delegates from 72 countries. A record number," he added with Gallic panache. "You'll know I've come to the end of my speech when I remind the delegates that there's one thing the Russians do better than anyone else on Earth."
Harry raised an eyebrow.
"The ballet. And we're all lucky enough to be attending Swan Lake at the Bolsha this evening. After I mention that to the delegates, I will invite you onto the stage to deliver the opening speech."
"I'm flattered," said Harry, "and better be on my toes."
"You shouldn't be," said Bouchard. "The committee were unanimous in their choice of you as the keynote speaker. We all admire the campaign you've been masterminding on behalf of Anatoly Babakov. The international press are showing considerable interest, and it will amuse you to know that the KGB asked me if they could see an advance copy of your speech."
Bouchard's words caused Harry a moment of anxiety. Until then, he hadn't realized how widely his campaign had been followed abroad and how much was expected of him. He looked at his watch, hoping there was still time to go over his speech once again, drained his coffee, apologized to Bouchard, and headed quickly back up to his room. It was a relief to find the lift was now working. He didn't need reminding that he might never have another opportunity like this to promote Babakov's cause, and certainly not in Russia's backyard. He almost ran into his room and pulled open the drawer of the small side table where he'd left his speech. It was no longer there. After searching the room, he realized that the KGB were now in possession of the advance copy they'd been so keen to get their hands on. He checked his watch again. 40 minutes before the conference opened, when he would be expected to deliver a speech he'd spent the last month working on, but no longer had a copy of. When 10 chimes rang out in Red Square, Harry was shaking like a schoolboy who had an appointment with his headmaster to discuss an essay that existed only in his head. He'd been left with no choice but to test out just how good his memory was. He walked slowly back downstairs, aware how an actor must feel moments before the curtain is due to rise, and joined a stream of delegates making their way to the conference center. On entering the ballroom, all he wanted to do was go straight back to his room and lock himself in. Bookshelves of chattering authors were even more intimidating than advancing Germans. Several delegates were searching for seats in a room that was already packed. But as instructed by Bouchard, Harry made his way to the front and took his place at the end of the second row. As he glanced around the vast hall, his eyes settled on a group of expressionless, heavily built men wearing long black coats, standing with their backs against the wall, evenly spaced around the room. They had one other thing in common. None of them looked as if they'd ever read a book in their lives. Bouchard was coming to the end of his opening address when he caught Harry's eye and gave him a warm smile.
"And now for the moment you've all been waiting for," he said. "An address by our distinguished colleague from England, the writer of 9 highly successful crime novels featuring Detective Sergeant William Warwick. I only wish that my own French counterpart, Inspector Benoit, was half as popular. Perhaps we are about to find out why."
After the laughter had died down, Bouchard continued,
It is my honor to invite Harry Clifton, the president of English Pen, to address the conference.
Harry made his way slowly up to the platform, surprised by the flashing bulbs of so many photographers surrounding the stage, while at the same time his every step was dogged by a stalking television crew. He shook hands with Bouchard before taking his place behind the lectern. He took a deep breath and looked up to face the firing squad.
Mr. President, he began, allow me to start by thanking you for your kind words. But I should warn you that I will not be speaking today about either Detective Sergeant William Warwick or Inspector Benoit, but about a man who is not a fictional character but flesh and blood, like every one of us in this room. A man who is unable to attend this conference today because he is locked up far away in the Siberian Gulag. His crime? Writing a book. I am, of course, referring to that martyr, and I use the word advisedly, Anatoly Babakov.
Even Harry was surprised by the outburst of applause that followed. Book conferences are usually sparsely attended by thoughtful academics who manage a polite round of applause once the speaker has sat down. But at least the interruption allowed him a few moments to gather his thoughts.
How many of us in this room have read books about Hitler, Churchill, or Roosevelt? Three of the four leaders who determined the outcome of the Second World War. But until recently, the only inside account about Joseph Stalin to come out of the Soviet Union was an official pamphlet censored by a committee of KGB officials. As you all know, the man who translated that book into English was so disillusioned with it that he decided to write his own unauthorized biography, which would surely have given us a different perspective of the man we all know as Uncle Joe. But no sooner was the book published than every copy of it was destroyed. Its publisher shut down, and, following a show trial, the author disappeared off the face of the earth. I'm not talking about Hitler's Germany, but present-day Russia. One or two of you may be curious to know what Anatoly Babakov could possibly have written that caused the authorities to act in such a tyrannical manner, myself included. After all, the Soviets never stopped trumpeting the glories of their utopian state, which they assure us is not only a model for the rest of the world, but one which, in time, we will have no choice but to copy. If that is the case, Mr. President, why can't we read a contrary view and make up our own minds? Don't let's forget that Uncle Joe was written by a man who stood one pace behind Stalin for 13 years, a confidant of his innermost thoughts, a witness to how he conducted his day-to-day life. But when Babakov decided to write his own version of those events, no one, including the Soviet people, were allowed to share his thoughts. I wonder why. You won't find a copy of Uncle Joe in any bookshop in England, America, Australia, Africa, or South America, and you certainly won't find one in the Soviet Union. Perhaps it's appallingly written, boring, without merit, and unworthy of our time. But at least let us be the judge of that.
Another wave of applause swept through the room. Harry had to suppress a smile when he noticed that the men in long black coats kept their hands firmly in their pockets, and their expressions didn't change when the interpreter translated his words. He waited for the applause to die down before he began his peroration.
Attending this conference today are historians, biographers, scientists, and even a few novelists, all of whom take for granted their latest work will be published, however critical they are of their governments, their leaders, even their political system. Why? Because you come from countries that can handle criticism, satire, mockery, even derision, and whose citizens can be entrusted to make up their own minds as to a book's merit. Authors from the Soviet Union are published only if the state approves of what they have to say. How many of you in this room will be languishing in jail if you had been born in Russia? I say to the leaders of this great country, why not allow your people the same privileges we in the West take for granted? You can start by releasing Anatoly Babakov and allowing his book to be published. That is, if you have nothing to fear from the torch of freedom. I will not rest until I can buy a copy of Uncle Joe at Hatchard's on Piccadilly, Doubleday on Fifth Avenue, Dimmock's in Sydney, and George's Bookshop in Park Street, Bristol. But most of all, I'd like to see a copy on the shelves of the Lenin Library in Wodzwieszenka Street, a few hundred yards from this hall. Although the applause was deafening, Harry just clung to the lectern, because he hadn't yet delivered his final paragraph. He waited for complete silence before he looked up and added, "Mr. President, on behalf of the British delegation, it is my privilege to invite Mr. Anatoly Babakov to be the keynote speaker at our international conference in London next year." Everyone in the room who wasn't wearing a long black coat rose to their feet to give Harry a standing ovation. A senior KGB official, who was seated in a box at the back of the room, turned to his superior and said,
"Word for word, he must have had a spare copy of the speech that we didn't know about."
"Mr. Knowles on line one, Chairman." Emma pressed a button on her phone. "Good afternoon, Jim."
"Good afternoon, Emma. I thought I'd give you a call because Desmond Mellor tells me he had a meeting with you, and he felt it went quite well."
"I'm sure he did," said Emma. "And I have to admit I was impressed with Mr. Mellor. Unquestionably a capable businessman, with a great deal of experience in his field."
"I agree," said Knowles. "So can I assume you'll be recommending he joins us on the board?"
"No, Jim, you cannot. Mr. Mellor has many admirable qualities, but in my opinion he has one overriding flaw."
"And what might that be?"
"He's only interested in one person, himself. The word loyalty is anathema to him. When I sat and listened to Mr. Mellor, he reminded me of my father, and I only want people on the board who remind me of my grandfather."
"That puts me in a very awkward position."
"Why would that be, Jim?"
"I recommended Mellor to the board in the first place, and your decision rather undermines my position."
"I'm sorry to hear you feel that way, Jim."
Emma paused before adding,
"Of course, I would understand if you felt you had to resign." Harry spent the rest of the day shaking hands with people he'd never met before, several of whom promised to promote Babakov's cause in their own countries. Glad-handing was something Giles, as a politician, did quite naturally, while Harry found it exhausting. However, he was pleased that he had walked the streets of Bristol with his brother-in-law during past election campaigns, because it wasn't until now that he realized just how much he picked up from him. By the time he climbed on the bus for the conference delegate's visit to the Bolshoi Theatre, he was so tired he feared he might fall asleep during the performance. But from the moment the curtain rose, he was on the edge of his seat, exhilarated by the artistic movement of the dancers, their skill, their grace, and their energy, making it impossible for him to take his eyes off the stage. When the curtain finally fell, he was in no doubt that this was one field in which the Soviet Union really did lead the world. When he returned to his hotel, the receptionist handed him a note confirming that an embassy car would pick him up at 7:50 the following morning so he could join the ambassador for breakfast. That would give him more than enough time to catch his 12:00 flight back to London. Two men sat silently in a corner of the lobby, observing his every move. Harry knew they would have read the message from the ambassador long before he had. He picked up his key, gave them a broad smile and wished them good night, before taking the lift to the 7th floor. Once he'd undressed, Harry collapsed onto the bed and quickly fell into a deep sleep.
Chapter 9. "Not a good move, Mama."
"Why not?" said Emma. "Jim Knowles has never been supportive, and frankly, I'll be glad to be rid of him.
Remember what Lyndon Johnson said about J. Edgar Hoover? I'd rather have him inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in."
"One sometimes wonders why your father and I spent so much money having you educated. But what harm can Knowles possibly do? He has a piece of information that could bring the company down. He wouldn't dare to make the Home Fleet incident public. If he did, he'd never get another job in the city. He doesn't have to make it public. All he has to do is have a quiet lunch at his club with Alex Fisher, and Lady Virginia will know every detail of what really happened that night, half an hour later. And you can be sure she'll save the most sensational bits for the witness box, because it would not only bring you down, but the company with it. No, I'm afraid you're going to have to eat a slice of humble pie, Mother, if you don't want to spend every day wondering when the bomb will finally drop. But Knowles has already made it clear that if Mellor isn't made a director, he'll resign from the board. Then Mr. Mellor will have to be offered a place on the board. Over my dead body. Your words, Mother, not mine. Tap, tap, tap. Harry's eyes blinked open. Tap, tap, tap. Was someone knocking on the door, or was it just noise coming from outside? Tap, tap, tap. It was definitely the door. He wanted to ignore it, but it had a persistence that suggested it wasn't going away. Tap, tap, tap. He reluctantly placed his feet on the cold linoleum floor, pulled on his dressing gown, and shuffled across to the door. If Harry was surprised when he opened the door, he tried not to show it.
"Hello, Harry," said a sultry voice.
Harry stared in disbelief at the girl he'd fallen in love with 20 years ago. A carbon copy of Emma in her early 20s stood in front of him, wearing a sable coat and, he suspected, nothing much else. She held a cigarette in one hand and a bottle of champagne in the other. Clever Russians, Harry thought.
"My name is Alina," she purred as she touched his arm. "I've been looking forward to meeting you."
"I think you've got the wrong room," said Harry.
"No, I don't think so," said Alina.
She tried to slip past him, but Harry remained lodged in the doorway, blocking her path.
"I'm your reward, Harry, for making such a brilliant speech. I promised the president that I'd give you a night you will never forget."
"You've already achieved that," said Harry, wondering which president Alina worked for.
"Surely there's something I can do for you, Harry."
"Nothing I can think of, but please thank your masters and let them know I'm just not interested."
Alina looked disappointed.
"Boys, perhaps?"
"No, thank you."
"Money?"
she suggested. "How kind, but I have enough already."
"Is there nothing I can tempt you with?"
"Well," said Harry, "now you mention it, there is something I've always wanted, and if your masters can deliver it, I'm their man."
"And what might that be, Harry?"
she said, sounding hopeful for the first time. "The Nobel Prize for Literature."
Alina looked puzzled, and Harry couldn't resist leaning forward and kissing her on both cheeks as if she was a favourite aunt. He quietly closed the door and crept back into bed.
"Damn the woman," he said, quite unable to sleep.
"There's a Mr. Vaughan on the line, Mr. Clifton," said the girl on the switchboard. "Says he needs to speak to Mr. Sloane urgently, but he's away at a conference in York and isn't expected back until Friday." "Put the call through to his secretary and ask her to deal with it." "Sarah's not answering her phone, Mr. Clifton. I don't think she's back from lunch yet."
"Okay, put him through," said Seb reluctantly.
"Good morning, Mr. Vaughan. How can I help you?"
"I'm the senior partner of Savills Estate Agents," said Vaughan, "and I need to speak to Mr. Sloane urgently."
"Can it wait until Friday?"
No. I now have two other offers on the table for Shifnal Farm in Shropshire, and as bidding closes on Friday, I need to know if Mr. Sloane is still interested."
"Perhaps you could give me the details, Mr. Vaughan," said Seb, picking up a pen, "and I'll look into it immediately."
"Could you let Mr. Sloane know that Mr. Collingwood is happy to accept his offer of £1.6 million, which means I'll need a deposit of £160,000 by 5 o'clock on Friday, if he still hopes to secure the deal?"
£1.6 million,
repeated Seb, not sure he'd heard the figure correctly.
"Yes, that of course includes the 1,000 acres as well as the house."
"Of course," said Seb. "I'll let Mr. Sloane know the moment he calls in."
Seb put down the phone. The amount was larger than any deal he'd ever been involved in for a London property, let alone a farm in Shropshire. So he decided to double-check with Sloane's secretary. He walked across the corridor to her office to find Sarah hanging up her coat.
Good afternoon, Mr. Clifton. How can I help? I need to see the Collingwood file, Sarah, so I can brief Mr. Sloane when he calls in.
Sarah looked puzzled.
I'm not familiar with that particular client, but just let me check.
She pulled open a filing cabinet marked A to H and quickly flicked through the C's.
He's not one of Mr. Sloane's clients, she said. There must be some mistake.
Try looking under Shifnal Farm, said Seb. Sarah turned her attention to the S to Z file, but once again shook her head.
Must be my mistake, said Seb. Perhaps it would be better if you didn't mention it to Mr. Sloane,
he added, as she closed the filing cabinet. He walked slowly back to his office, closed the door, and thought about his conversation with Mr. Vaughan for some time before he picked up the phone and dialed directory inquiries. When a voice eventually answered, Seb asked for a Mr. Collingwood at Shifnal Farm in Shropshire. It was a few moments before the operator came back on the line.
I have a Mr. D. Collingwood, Shifnal Farm, Shifnal.
That must be him. Can you give me his number?
I'm afraid not, sir. He's ex-directory.
But this is an emergency.
It may well be, sir, but I'm not allowed to give out ex-directory numbers under any circumstances.
The phone went dead. Seb hesitated for a moment before he picked up the phone again and dialed an internal number.
Chairman's office, said a familiar voice. Rachel, I need 15 minutes with the boss.
5:45, but no more than 15 minutes, because he has a meeting with the deputy chairman at 6, and Mr. Buchanan is never late.
The Embassy Rolls-Royce, Union Jacks fluttering on both wings, was waiting outside the Majestic Hotel long before Harry appeared in the lobby at 7:50 that morning. The same two men were slumped in the corner, pretending not to notice him. Did they ever sleep, Harry wondered. After Harry had checked out, he couldn't resist giving his guards a little farewell bow before he left the hotel, Majestic in nothing but name. A chauffeur opened the back door of the Rolls to allow Harry to step inside. He leant back and began to think about the other reason he'd come to Moscow. The car made its way through the rain-swept streets of the capital, passing St. Basil's Cathedral, a building of rare beauty, nestled at the south end of Red Square. The car crossed the Moskva, turned left, and a few moments later the gates of the British Embassy opened, splitting the royal crest in two. The chauffeur drove into the compound and came to a halt outside the front door. Harry was impressed. A palatial residence worthy of a czar towered over him, reminding visitors of Britain's past empire rather than its reduced status in the post-war world. The next surprise came when he saw the ambassador standing on the embassy steps, waiting to greet him.
"Good morning, Mr. Clifton," said Sir Humphrey Trevelyan as Harry stepped out of the car.
"Good morning, Your Excellency," said Harry, as the two men shook hands, which was appropriate, as they were about to close a deal.
The ambassador led him into a vast circular hall that boasted a life-size statue of Queen Victoria, as well as a full-length portrait of her great-great-granddaughter.
"You won't have read the Times this morning," said Trevelyan, "but I can tell you that your speech to the Penn Conference seems to have had the desired effect."
"Let's hope so," said Harry. "But I'll only be convinced when Babakov is released."
"That might take a little longer," warned the ambassador. "The Soviets are not known for rushing into anything, especially if it wasn't their idea in the first place. It might be wise to prepare yourself for the long game. Don't be disheartened, though, because I can tell you the Politburo has been surprised by the support you've received from the international community. However, the other side of that coin is that you're now considered persona non grata."
He led his guest down a marble corridor, dominated by portraits of British monarchs who had not suffered the same fate as their Russian relatives. A floor-to-ceiling double door was pulled open by two servants, although the ambassador was still several paces away. He walked straight into his study, took his place behind a large, uncluttered desk, and waved Harry into the seat opposite him.
"I have given instructions that we are not to be disturbed," said Trevelyan,
as he selected a key from a chain and unlocked his desk drawer. He pulled out a file and extracted a single sheet of paper, which he handed to Harry.
"Take your time, Mr. Clifton. You are not under the same restrictions that Sir Alan imposed on you."
Harry began to study a random list of names, addresses, and telephone numbers that seemed to have no sequence or logic to them. After he'd gone over it a second time, he said,
"I think I have it, sir."
The incredulous look on the ambassador's face suggested that he wasn't convinced.
"Well, let's be sure, shall we?"
He retrieved the list and replaced it with a couple of sheets of embassy notepaper and a fountain pen. Harry took a deep breath and began to write out the 12 names, 9 addresses, and 21 telephone numbers. Once he'd completed the task, he handed his effort back to the ambassador to be marked. Sir Humphrey slowly checked it against the original.
"You spelled Pengelly with one L instead of two."
Harry frowned.
"Perhaps you'll be kind enough to repeat the exercise, Mr. Clifton,"
the ambassador said, as he sat back, struck a match, and set light to Harry's first effort. Harry completed his second attempt far more quickly.
"Bravo,"
said the ambassador, after double-checking it.
"I only wish you were a member of my staff. Now, as we can assume the Soviets will have read the note I left at your hotel, perhaps we shouldn't disappoint them."
He pressed the button under his desk, and a few moments later the doors opened again, and 2 members of staff dressed in white linen jackets and black trousers entered, pushing a trolley. Over a breakfast of hot coffee, brown toast, Oxford marmalade, and an egg that had been produced by a chicken, the 2 men chatted about everything from England's chances in the forthcoming test series against the South Africans. Harry felt that England would win, the ambassador wasn't convinced, the abolition of hanging, Harry in favour, the ambassador against, Britain joining the common market, something they were able to agree on. They never once touched on the real reason they were having breakfast together. When the trolley was removed and they were once again alone, Trevelyan said,
"Forgive me for being a bore, old chap, but would you be kind enough to carry out the exercise one more time?"
Harry returned to the ambassador's desk and wrote out the list for a third time.
"Remarkable. I now understand why Sir Alan chose you."
Trevelyan led his guest out of the room.
"My car will take you to the airport, and although you may think you have more than enough time, I have a feeling the customs officials will assume I have given you something to take back to England, and you will therefore be subject to a lengthy search. They are right, of course. But fortunately, it's not something they can get their hands on. So, all that is left for me to do, Mr. Clifton, is to thank you, and suggest that you do not write out the list until the wheels of the aircraft have left the tarmac. You might even feel it advisable to wait until you are no longer in Soviet airspace. After all, there's bound to be someone on board watching your every move."
Sir Humphrey accompanied his guests to the front door, and they shook hands for a second time before Harry climbed into the back of the Rolls-Royce. The ambassador remained on the top step until the car was out of sight. The chauffeur dropped Harry outside Sheremetyevo Airport 2 hours before his flight was due to take off. The ambassador turned out to be correct, because Harry spent the next hour in customs, where they checked and double-checked everything in his suitcase, before unstitching the lining of his jacket and overcoat. After they had failed to find anything, he was taken to a small room and asked to remove his clothes. When their efforts failed yet again, a doctor appeared and searched in places Harry hadn't even considered before, but certainly wouldn't be describing in graphic detail in his next book. An hour later, his case was reluctantly given a chalk cross to show it had been cleared, but it never did turn up in London. He decided not to protest, even though the guards at customs also failed to return his overcoat, a Christmas present from Emma. He would have to buy an identical one from Ede and Ravenscroft before he drove back to Bristol, as he didn't want his wife to find out the real reason Sir Alan had wanted to see him. When Harry finally boarded the plane, he was delighted to find he'd been upgraded to first class, as he had been on the last occasion he'd worked for the cabinet secretary.
equally pleasing. No one had been allocated the seat beside him. Sir Alan didn't leave anything to chance. He waited until he had been in the air for over an hour before asking a steward for a couple of sheets of BOAC writing paper. But when they arrived, he changed his mind. Two men seated across the aisle from him had glanced in his direction once too often. He adjusted his seat back, closed his eyes, and went over the list in his mind again and again. By the time the plane touched down at Heathrow, he was mentally and physically exhausted. He was only glad being a spy wasn't his full-time job. Harry was the first to disembark from the aircraft, and he wasn't surprised to see Sir Alan waiting on the tarmac at the bottom of the steps. He joined him in the back of a car that made its way quickly out of the airport without being bothered by a customs officer. Other than, "Good morning, Clifton," the cabinet secretary didn't say a word before he passed over the inevitable pad and pen. Harry wrote out the 12 names, 9 addresses, and 21 telephone numbers that had been lodged in his mind for several hours. He double-checked the list before handing it to Sir Alan.
"I am most grateful," he said, "and I thought you'd be pleased to hear that I've added a couple of paragraphs to the speech the Foreign Secretary will be making at the UN next week, which I hope will assist Mr. Babakov's cause. By the way, did you spot my two minders sitting across the aisle from you in first class? I put them there to protect you, just in case you had any trouble."
"There's no deal for 1.6 million in the offing that I'm aware of," said Cedric, "and it's hardly likely to be something I'd forget. I'm bound to wonder what Sloane's up to."
"I've no idea," said Sebastian, "but I'm sure there's a simple explanation."
"And you say he won't be back until Friday?"
"That's right. He's at a conference in York."
"So that gives us a couple of days to look into it. You're probably right, and there's a simple explanation. But 1.6 million, he repeated. "And Mr. Collingwood has accepted his offer."
"That's what Mr. Vaughan of Savile said."
"Ralph Vaughan is old school and doesn't make that kind of mistake."
Cedric remained silent for a few moments before adding,
"You better go up to Shifnal first thing in the morning and start digging around. Begin at the local pub. The publican always knows everything that's going on in his village, and 1.6 million would have all the gossips chattering. After you've spoken to him, check the local estate agents, but make sure you don't go anywhere near Collingwood. If you do, Sloane is certain to hear about it, and will assume you're trying to undermine him. I think we'd better keep this between ourselves in case it turns out to be totally innocent. When you get back to London, come straight round to Cadogan Place and you can brief me over dinner."
Seb decided that this wasn't the time to tell Cedric that he booked a table at the Mirabelle for dinner tomorrow night with Samantha. The clock on the mantelpiece struck 6, so he knew the deputy chairman, Ross Buchanan, would be waiting outside. He rose to leave.
"Well done, Seb," said Cedric. "Let's hope there is a simple explanation. But in any case, thank you for keeping me briefed."
Seb nodded. When he reached the door, he turned back to say goodnight, to see Cedric swallowing a pill. He pretended not to notice as he closed the door behind him. Chapter 10 Seb was up, dressed, and had left the house before Sam woke the following morning. Cedric Harcastle never travelled first class, but he always allowed his senior management to do so when it was a long journey. Although Seb picked up a copy of the Financial Times at Euston, he barely glanced at the headlines during the 3-hour journey to Shropshire. His mind was preoccupied with how best to use his time once he arrived in Shifnal. The train pulled into Shrewsbury Station just after 11:30, and Seb didn't hesitate to take a taxi on to Shifnal, rather than wait for the connecting train, because on this occasion time was money. He waited until they had left the county town behind them, before he fired his first question at the driver.
"Which is the best pub in Shifnal?"
"Depends what you're looking for. Good grub or the best ale in the country."
"I always think you can judge a pub by its landlord."
"Then it has to be the Shifnal Arms, owned by Fred and Sheila Ramsey. They don't just run the pub, but the village as well. He's president of the local cricket club and used to open the bowling for the village. Even played for the county on a couple of occasions. And she sits on the parish council. But be warned, the food's lousy.
Then it's the Shifnal Arms, said Seb. He sat back and began to go over his strategy, aware that he didn't need Sloane to discover why he wasn't in the office. The taxi drew up outside the Shifnal Arms a few minutes after 12. Seb would have given the driver a larger tip, but he didn't want to be remembered. He strolled into the pub, trying to look casual, which wasn't easy when you're the first customer of the day, and took a close look at the man standing behind the bar. Although he must have been over 40, and his cheeks and nose revealed that he enjoyed the product he sold, while his paunch suggested he preferred pork pies to fine dining, it was not hard to believe this giant of a man had once opened the bowling for Shifnal.
"Afternoon," said the landlord. "What can I get you?"
"A half of your local beer will suit me fine," said Seb, who didn't usually drink during working hours, but today it was part of the job.
The publican drew half a pint of Reekin IPA and placed it on the bar.
"That'll be 1 shilling and 6p."
Half the price Seb would have had to pay in London. He took a sip.
"Not bad," he said,
before bowling his first long hop.
"It's not a West Country brew, but it's not half bad."
"So you're not from round these parts," said the publican.
"No, I'm a Gloucestershire lad, born and bred," Seb told him, before taking another sip.
"So what brings you to Shifnal?"
"My firm is opening a branch in Shrewsbury, and my wife won't agree to the move unless I can find a house in the country."
"You don't play cricket, by any chance?"
"I open the batting for the Somerset Stragglers, another reason why I'm not that keen on moving."
"We've got a decent enough 11, but we're always on the lookout for fresh talent."
Seb pointed to a photograph behind the bar. "Is that you holding up the cup?"
"It is. 1951, when I was about 15 years younger and some 15 pounds lighter. We won the County Cup that year for the first and, I'm sorry to say, last time. Although we did reach the semi-finals last year."
Time for another slow, long hop.
"If I was thinking of buying a house in the area, who would you suggest I deal with?"
"Well, there's only one half-decent estate agent in town, Charlie Watkins, my wicket-keeper. You'll find his place on the High Street. Can't miss it."
"Then I'll go and have a chat with Mr. Watkins and come back for a bite of lunch."
"Dish of the day is steak and kidney pie," said the publican, patting his stomach.
"I'll see you later," said Seb, after he'd downed his drink.
It wasn't difficult to find the High Street or to spot Watkins' estate agency with its gaudy sign flapping in the breeze. Seb took some time studying the properties for sale in the window. The prices seemed to range from £700 to £12,000, so how was it possible for anything in the area to be worth £1.6 million? He opened the front door to the sound of a jangling bell, and as he stepped inside, a young man looked up from behind his desk.
"Is Mr. Watkins around?" asked Seb.
"He's with a customer at the moment, but he shouldn't be long," he added,
as a door behind him opened and two men walked out.
"I'll have the paperwork completed by Monday at the latest, so if you could arrange for the deposit to be lodged with your solicitor, that should help move things along,"
the elder of the two men said, as he opened the door for his customer.
"This gentleman's waiting to see you, Mr. Watkins," said the young man behind the desk.
"Good morning,"
said Watkins, thrusting out his hand.
"Come into my office."
He opened the door and ushered his potential client through. Seb walked into a small room that boasted a partner's desk and three chairs. On the walls were photographs of past triumphs, every one marked with a red sticker declaring sold. Seb's eyes settled on a large property with several acres. He needed Watkins to quickly work out which end of the market he was interested in. A warm smile appeared on the estate agent's face.
"Is that the type of property you're looking for?"
"I was hoping to find a large country house with several acres of farmland attached," Seb said,
as he took the seat opposite Watkins.
I'm afraid that sort of thing doesn't come on the market very often. But I have one or two properties that might interest you."
He leant back, pulled open the drawer of the only filing cabinet, and extracted three folders.
"But I have to warn you, sir, that the price of farmland has rocketed since the government decided to allow tax relief for anyone investing in agricultural land."
Seb didn't comment as Watkins opened the first folder.
"Asgarth Farm is situated on the Welsh border, 700 acres, mainly arable, and a magnificent Victorian mansion. In need of a little repair,"
he added reluctantly.
"And the price?"
$320,000, said Watkins,
passing over the brochure before quickly adding,
"or near offer."
Seb shook his head.
"I was hoping for something with at least 1,000 acres.
Watkins's eyes lit up, as if he'd won the pools.
"There is one exceptional property that's recently come on the market, but I'm only a sub-agent, and unfortunately bids have to be in by 5 this Friday.
If it's the right property, that wouldn't put me off."
Watkins opened his desk drawer and, for the first time, offered a customer Shifnal Farm.
"This looks more interesting," said Seb,
as he turned the pages of the brochure.
"How much are they asking?"
The estate agent hesitated, almost as if he didn't want to reveal the figure. Seb waited patiently.
"I know there's a bid in with Savills for 1.6 million, said Watkins.
His turn to wait patiently, expecting the client to reject it out of hand.
"Perhaps I could study the details over lunch, and then come back this afternoon and discuss it with you?
In the meantime, shall I make arrangements for you to see over the property?"
That was the last thing Seb wanted, so he quickly replied,
"I'll make that decision once I've had a chance to check the details."
"Time is against us, sir."
True enough, thought Seb.
"I'll let you know my decision when I come back this afternoon,"
he repeated a little more firmly.
"Yes, of course, sir,"
said Watkins as he leapt up, accompanied him to the door, and after shaking hands once again, said,
"I look forward to seeing you later."
Seb stepped out onto the high street and made his way quickly back to the pub. Mr. Ramsay was standing behind the bar, polishing a glass when Seb sat on the stool in front of him.
"Any luck?"
"Possibly," said Seb,
placing the glossy brochure on the counter so the landlord couldn't miss it.
"Another half, please, and won't you join me?"
"Thank you, sir. Will you be having lunch?"
"I'll have the steak and kidney pie," said Seb,
studying the menu chalked up on a blackboard behind the bar. Ramsay didn't take his eyes off the brochure, even as he drew the customer's half pint.
"I can tell you a thing or two about that property,"
he said, as his wife came out of the kitchen.
"Seems a bit overpriced to me," said Seb,
bowling his third long hop.
"I should say so," said Ramsay. "Only 5 years back it were on the market at 300,000, and even at that price, young Mr. Collingwood couldn't shift it."
"The new tax incentives could be the reason,"
suggested Seb.
"That wouldn't explain the price I'm hearing."
"Perhaps the owner's been granted planning permission to build on the land. The housing or one of those new industrial estates the government is so keen on."
"Not on your Nelly,"
said Mrs. Ramsay as she joined them.
"The parish council may not have any power, but that lot at County Hall still have to keep us informed if they want to build anything, from a letterbox to a multi-story car park. It's been our right since Magna Carta to be allowed to lodge an objection and hold up proceedings for 90 days. Not that they take much notice after that."
"Then there has to be oil, gold, or the lost treasure of the pharaohs buried under the land,"
said Seb, trying to make light of it.
"I've heard wilder suggestions than that," said Ramsay. "A hoard of Roman coins worth millions, buried treasure. But my favourite is that Collingwood was one of them train robbers, and Shifnal Farm is where they buried the loot."
"And don't forget,"
said Mrs. Ramsay, reappearing with the steak and kidney pie,
"Mr. Swan says he knows exactly why the price has rocketed, but he won't tell anyone unless they make a substantial donation to his school theatre appeal."
"Mr. Swan,"
said Seb, as he picked up his knife and fork.
"Used to be headmaster of the local grammar school. Retired some years back and now devotes his time to raising money for the school theatre.
bit obsessed with the idea, if you ask me.
Do you think we can beat the South Africans? Asked Seb, having gained the information he needed and now wanting to move on.
MJK Smith will have his hands full with that lot, said the barman. But if you ask me...
Seb sipped his beer, while selecting carefully which parts of the steak and kidney pie he could safely eat. He settled on the burnt crust, as he continued to listen to the landlord's views on everything from the Beatles being awarded the MBE, Harold Wilson after the Young vote, to the possibility of the Americans landing a man on the moon. What's the point? When a rowdy group of customers entered the pub and Ramsay became distracted, Seb left half a crown on the bar and slipped out. Once he was back on the street, he asked a woman clutching the hand of a young boy where the grammar school was.
About half a mile up the road, she said. You can't miss it.
It felt more like a mile, but he certainly couldn't miss the vast red-brick Victorian edifice which John Betjeman would have admired. Seb didn't even have to pass through the school gates before he spotted what he was looking for. A prominent notice announced an appeal for £10,000 to build a new theatre for the school. Next to it was a large drawing of a thermometer, but Seb observed that the red line only reached £1,766. To learn more about the project, please contact Mr. Morris Swan, M.A., Oxon, on Shifnal 2613. Seb wrote down two numbers in his diary, 8234 and 2613, then turned and headed back towards the high street. In the distance, he spotted a red telephone box, and he was pleased to see it wasn't occupied. He stepped inside and rehearsed his lines for a few moments before checking the number in his diary. He dialed 2613, pressed four pennies into the slot, and waited for some time before an elderly voice answered.
Morris Swan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Swan. My name is Clifton. I'm the head of corporate donations for Farthing's Bank, and we are considering making a donation to your theatre appeal. I wonder if it might be possible for us to meet. I would, of course, be quite happy to come and see you.
No, I'd prefer to meet at the school, said Swan eagerly. Then I can show you what we have planned.
That's fine, said Seb. But unfortunately, I'm only in Shifnal for the day and will be returning to London this evening.
Then I'll come over immediately. Why don't I see you outside the school gates in 10 minutes?
I look forward to meeting you, said Seb. He put the phone down and quickly retraced his steps back to the grammar school. He didn't have to wait long before he spotted a frail-looking gentleman walking slowly towards him with the aid of a stick. After Seb had introduced himself, Swan said,
As you have such a short time, Mr. Clifton, why don't I take you straight through to the Memorial Hall, where I can show you the architect's plans for the new theatre and answer any questions you might have.
Seb followed the old man through the school gates, across the yard and into the hall, while listening to him talk about the importance of young people having their own theatre and what a difference it would make to the local community. Seb took his time studying the detailed architect's drawings that were pinned to the wall, while Swan continued to enthuse about the project.
As you can see, Mr. Clifton, although we will have a proscenium arch, there would still be enough room backstage to store props, while the actors standing in the wings won't be cramped. And if I raise the full amount, the boys and girls will be able to have separate dressing rooms.
He stood back.
My life's dream, he admitted, which I hope to see completed before I die. But may I ask why your bank will be interested in a small project in Shifnal?
We are currently buying land in the area on behalf of clients who are interested in taking advantage of the government's latest tax incentives. We realise that's not likely to be popular in the village, so we've decided to support some local projects.
Would one of those pieces of land be Shifnal Farm?
Seb was taken by surprise by Swan's question, and it was some time before he managed...
No, we looked at Mr. Collingwood's property and, on balance, decided it was overpriced.
How many children do you think I've taught in my lifetime, Mr. Clifton?
I've no idea, said Seb, puzzled by the question.
Just over 3,000.
so I know when someone is trying to get away with only telling me half the story.
I'm not sure I understand, sir.
You understand all too well, Mr. Clifton. The truth is you're on a fishing trip, and you have absolutely no interest in my theatre. What you really want to know is why someone is willing to pay £1.6 million for Shifnal Farm when no one else has bid anywhere near that amount. Am I right?
Yes, admitted Seb. And if I knew the answer to that question, I'm sure my bank would be willing to make a substantial donation towards your new theatre.
When you're an old man, Mr. Clifton, and you will be one day, you'll find you have a bit of time on your hands, especially if you've led an active and worthwhile life. So when someone bid far too much for Shifnal Farm, my curiosity got the better of me, and I decided to spend some of my spare time trying to find out why. I began, like any good detective, by looking for clues, and I can tell you that after 6 months of diligent research, following up even the most unlikely leads, I now know exactly why someone is willing to pay way over the asking price for Shifnal Farm.
Seb could feel his heart thumping.
And if you want to know what it is that I've found out, you won't just make a substantial donation to the school theatre. You'll finance the entire project.
But what if you're wrong?
That's a risk you're going to have to take, Mr. Clifton, because there's only a couple of days before the bidding closes.
Then you must also be willing to take the risk, said Seb. Because I'm not going to fork out over £8,000 unless, and until, you're proved right.
Before I agree to that, it's my turn to ask you a question.
Of course, said Seb.
Are you by any chance related to Harry Clifton, the author?
Yes, he's my father.
I thought I saw a resemblance. Although I've never read any of his books, I've followed his campaign for Anatoly Babakov with great interest. And if Harry Clifton is your father, that's good enough for me.
Thank you, sir, said Seb.
Now, sit down, young man, because time is against us.
Seb perched on the edge of the stage, while Swan took him slowly through the meticulous research he carried out during the past 6 months. That had led him to only one conclusion. A conclusion Seb couldn't find fault with. He jumped down from the stage.
May I ask you one more question before I leave, sir?
Of course, young man.
Why didn't you tell Collingwood what you'd discovered? After all, he couldn't have lost a penny if he didn't have to pay up until you were proved right.
I taught Dan Collingwood when he was at the grammar school, said Swan. Even as a boy, he was greedy and stupid. And he hasn't improved much since. But he wasn't interested in what I might have to tell him, just fob me off with a £5 donation and wish me luck.
So you haven't told this to anyone else? Said Seb, trying not to sound anxious.
The old man hesitated for a moment.
I did tell one other person, he admitted. But I haven't heard from him since.
Seb didn't need to ask his name. Sebastian knocked on the door of 37 Cadogan Place just after 8 o'clock. Cedric answered the summons and, without a word, led his young protégé through to the drawing-room. Seb's eyes immediately settled on a Hockney landscape hanging above the fireplace before he admired the Henry Moore maquette on the sideboard. Seb didn't doubt that if Picasso had been born in Yorkshire, his work would also be part of Cedric's collection.
"Would you care to join me for a glass of wine?" asked Cedric. "Châteauneuf du Pape, 1959, which, from the expression on your face, I have a feeling you may have earned."
"Thank you, sir," said Seb, as he sank into the nearest chair.
Cedric handed him a glass and took the seat opposite him.
"When you've caught your breath, take me through the day, slowly."
Seb took a sip. Not a vintage Mr. Ramsay will be serving at the Shifnal Arms that evening.
When Seb came to the end of his tale 20 minutes later, Cedric remarked,
"Swan sounds to me like a shrewd old cove. I have a feeling I'd like him. But what did you learn from the encounter?"
A question he had frequently posed when Seb had been his personal assistant. "Just because a man is physically frail doesn't mean his mind isn't still sharp."
"Good. Anything else?"
"The importance of reputation."
"Your father's in this case," Cedric reminded him. "If you get nothing else out of today, Seb, that lesson alone will have made your journey to Shifnal worthwhile. However, now I have to face the fact that one of my most senior members of staff may be dealing behind my back."
He took a sip of wine before he continued.
"It is possible, of course, that Sloane will have a simple explanation, but somehow I doubt it."
Seb suppressed a smile. "But shouldn't we do something about the deal, now we know what the government has in mind?"
"All in good time. First, I'll need to have a word with Ralph Vaughan, because he's not going to be pleased when I withdraw the bank's offer, and he'll be even more angry when I tell him the reason why."
"But won't he simply accept one of the lower offers?"
"Not if he thinks there's still a chance he might get a higher price if he hangs on for a few more days."
"And Mr. Swan?"
"I'm tempted to give him the £8,234, whatever happens. I think he's earned it."
Cedric took another sip of wine before he added,
"But there's nothing else we can do tonight, Seb. I suggest you go home. In fact, as all hell is going to break loose tomorrow, perhaps it might be wise for you to take the day off and stay as far away from the office as possible. But report to me first thing on Monday morning, as I have a feeling you could be on your way back to Shropshire."
As they left the room and walked down the corridor towards the front door, Cedric said,
"I hope you didn't have anything planned for this evening."
"Nothing special," thought Seb. "I was just going to take Samantha out to dinner and ask her to marry me." Chapter 11. Once Sebastian realized that he wouldn't be expected back at the office before Monday morning, he began to plan a surprise weekend for Samantha. He spent the morning booking trains, planes, hotels, and even checked the opening times of the Rice Museum. He wanted the weekend in Amsterdam to be perfect. So when they emerged from customs, he ignored the signs for buses and trains and headed straight for the taxi rank.
"Cedric must have been pleased when you discovered what Sloane was up to," said Sam, as the cab joined the traffic making its way out of the airport. "What do you think will happen next?"
"I expect Sloane will be sacked around 5 o'clock this afternoon."
"Why 5 this afternoon?"
"That's when he was hoping to close the Shifnal Farm deal."
"There's almost an element of Greek tragedy about that," said Sam. "So with a bit of luck, Sloane will be gone by the time you turn up for work on Monday."
"Almost certainly, because Cedric asked me to report to him first thing."
"Do you think you'll get Sloane's job?" asked Sam as the cab headed onto the motorway.
"Possibly, but it's only likely to be a temporary appointment while Cedric looks for someone more experienced.
But if you manage to pull off the Shifnal deal, he might not bother to look for someone else."
"That's also a possibility. And I wouldn't be surprised to find I was on a train back to Shrewsbury on Monday."
"Did he go left around that roundabout?"
"No, right," said Sam, laughing. "Don't forget we're on the continent."
She turned to Seb, who was clinging on to the front seat, and placed a hand on his leg.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "I sometimes forget about that dreadful accident."
"I'm fine," said Seb.
"I like the sound of Mr. Swan. Perhaps it would be wise to keep him on your side."
"Cedric agrees with you. And if we pull off the deal, we'll probably end up having to build his school a concert hall," Seb added, as they entered the outskirts of the city.
"I assume we're staying at the Amstel," said Sam, as the deluxe 5-star hotel overlooking the Amstel River loomed up in front of them.
"Not this time. That will have to wait until I'm chairman of the bank. But until then, it's the Pension di Canal, a well-known 1-star guest house frequented by the up-and-coming."
Sam smiled as the taxi drew up outside a little guest house wedged between a greengrocer and an Indonesian restaurant.
"Far better than the Amstel," she declared, as they walked into the cramped lobby.
Once they checked in, Seb lugged their bags up to the top floor, as the pension didn't have a lift or a porter. He unlocked the door of their room and switched on the light.
"Palatial," Sam declared.
Seb couldn't believe how small the room was. There was only just enough space for them to stand on each side of the double bed.
"I'm so sorry," he said. "I wanted this weekend to be just perfect."
Sam took him in her arms.
"You are a silly thing at times. This is perfect. I prefer being up and coming. Gives us something to look forward to."
Seb fell back on the bed.
"I know what I'm looking forward to."
"A visit to the Rijksmuseum?" suggested Sam.
"You wanted to see me,"
said Sloane as he marched into the chairman's office. He didn't wait to be offered a seat. Cedric looked up at the head of his property division, but didn't smile.
"I've just finished reading your monthly report."
"Up 2.2% on last month,"
Sloane reminded him.
"Very impressive. But I wonder if you might have done even better if..."
"If what, Chairman?" said Sloane abruptly.
"If Shifnal Farm had also been included in your report," said Cedric, picking up a brochure from his desk.
"Shifnal Farm? Are you sure that's one of my properties and not Clifton's?"
said Sloane, nervously touching the knot of his tie.
"I'm absolutely certain it's one of your properties, Sloane. What I can't be sure about is whether it's one of the bank's."
"What are you getting at?" said Sloane, suddenly on the defensive.
"When I called Ralph Vaughan, the senior partner of Savills, a few moments ago, he confirmed that you put in a bid of £1.6 million for the property, with the bank acting as guarantor."
Sloane shifted uneasily in his chair.
"You're quite right, Chairman, but as the deal hasn't finally been closed, you won't have all the details until I send you next month's report." "One of the details that will take some explaining is why the account is registered to a client in Zurich."
"Ah, yes," said Sloane. "Now I remember. You're quite right. We were acting for a Swiss client who prefers anonymity. But the bank charges 3% commission on every deal we carry out for that particular customer."
"And it didn't take a great deal of research," said Cedric, patting a pile of papers on the desk in front of him, "to discover that that particular client has conducted another 6 transactions during the past year and made himself a handsome profit."
"But isn't that what my department is supposed to do?"
protested Sloane. "Make profits for our clients, while at the same time earning the bank a handsome commission."
"It is indeed,"
said Cedric, trying to remain calm.
"It's just a pity the Swiss client's account is in your name."
"How can you possibly know that?" blurted out Sloane, "when client accounts in Switzerland are not named but numbered."
"I didn't. But you've just confirmed my worst fears. So your number is up."
Sloane leapt from his chair.
"I've made a 23% profit for the bank over the past 10 months.
"And if my calculations are correct," came back Cedric, "you've made another 41% for yourself during the same period. And I have a feeling Shifnal Farm was going to be your biggest payday yet."
Sloane collapsed back in his chair, a look of desperation on his face.
"But I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news," continued Cedric. "But this is one deal you're not going to pull off for your Swiss client, because I called Mr. Vaughan at Savills a few minutes ago and withdrew our bid for Shifnal Farm."
"But we could have made a massive profit on that deal,"
said Sloane, now staring defiantly at the chairman.
"Possibly as much as £1 million.
"I don't think you mean we," said Cedric. "I think you mean you. Although it was the bank's money you were putting up as collateral, not your own."
"But you only know half the facts."
"I can assure you, Sloane, that thanks to Mr. Swan, I know all the facts."
Sloane rose slowly from his seat.
"You are a stupid old man," he said,
spitting out the words. You're out of touch, and you don't begin to understand modern